I will call to order the Energy Policy Committee on March 12, 2013. Today we have one item on our agenda, and that is the walkthrough of the DE3 amendment to House File 956, the Omnibus Energy Bill. Representative Hortman, we don't have a quorum yet, so we can't move your bill, but you know, early bird gets the worm. So if you would like to, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to understand what the deadline for amendments. I've got a few of them being drafted.
Representative Quam, I believe that the deadline for amendments, we will be marking up the bill tomorrow night. Deadline for amendments will be noon tomorrow. Thank you, Representative Quam. Mr. Ela.
Mr. Chair, could you clarify that noon due to the committee?
Mr. Eliff?
Yes. I'm sorry, Mr. Eliff. Yes, noon due to the committee. Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Eliff, we can discuss after committee whether there should be a difference and a nuance in how we structure the deadline to accommodate the limitations of staff and the capacity of the revisor's office and House research. And we'll send an updated nuanced deadline to committee members if we feel we need to. I know it's pretty quick turnaround. We posted the DE3 on the internet 10:30 on Monday night, and I know we have very few staff who are really experienced in this area of the law, and so we'll have to just see if it's realistic for all members to get their amendments back in time to meet the noon deadline. I don't plan on being super crazy strict on that. I want to make sure that we know ahead of time what's coming in, but I think we're going to have to see if that works for everybody. The plan is get your amendments in by noon, but if we find that people are being constrained by the resources available to them, then we will update that.
Always a much better answer from Representative Hortman, Mr. Ela.
Thank you.
Without further questions, Representative Hortman, why don't we at least begin to discuss the DE3 amendment, and then we'll move the bill and the amendment when we have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, we're not going to move the DE3 today. Today, we're just going to talk about it. Tomorrow in committee, we'll be moving the DE3 amendment to House File 956, and this amendment will form the basis of the Energy Policy Omnibus Bill for 2013. I expect to offer as author's amendments, with the support of the committee, the substance of several bills that we heard yesterday. I didn't think it was appropriate or fair to include language from bills that we hadn't heard yet in the proposed DE3. So I expect to include the substance of House Files 1015, the Seltzer Excel Bill, 1000, the Kelly Clean Energy Resource Team Bill, 1084, the Kelly Excel Bill, and 1326, the McNamer-Ottertail Bill. And I know that folks are working on language changes with the Department of Commerce to address their concerns. And then I know members will be offering portions of their bills as amendments to the DE3. And I think some of those amendments will be successful. In particular, I'm hopeful that stakeholders will continue working with Representative Morgan on the community solar language in House File 1146, because I believe that belongs as a component of the committee bill. The DE3 amendment contains portions of Representative Morgan's Solar Jobs Act and Representative Hornstein's bill, and the governor's proposed next steps in energy policy for our state. On February 6th in the State of the State, Governor Dayton called upon us to take strong leadership in energy policy. He asked, "Are we progressing fast enough? Are we doing all we can to utilize other renewables, such as solar, and to make Minnesota the best place to locate these new industries and their jobs?" He challenged us to use our past achievements as springboards for Minnesota's next big leap towards a sustainable energy future. He did not ask us to take a timid leap. He did not ask us to take a tiny step or a first step or a tentative step. He asked us to make a big leap towards a sustainable energy future. At the same time that we seek to be a national leader, as we always have in renewable energy and environmental issues, we also have to be practical and pragmatic and look at what's achievable. We all share the goal for our constituents of having secure, reliable, and cost-effective energy now and into the future. We are at a turning point in Minnesota's energy path. Our reporter David Schaefer from the Star Tribune wrote a series of articles earlier this winter. On the impending retirement of several coal-fired power plants in the state. I always should keep one of those for myself. By 2016, we'll be shutting down coal plants that produce hundreds of megawatts of power. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, as we retire these coal-fired power plants that provide a massive amount of energy to our state, will we replace them with new coal plants, or are we willing to take 1.33% of our energy dollars and invest in a new direction and add to our already considerable success in the area of renewables? None of us would have 50% of our 401k in one stock, but that's exactly where we are in the state in our energy picture with regard to coal. 50% of our state's electrical energy is supplied by coal. We've made substantial progress in increasing the amount of renewables from the policies we enacted in 1994, 2001, and 2007. At this point in Minnesota's energy picture, 2,000 gigawatt hours a month comes from coal, 750,000 comes from nuclear-fired power, less than 500 gigawatt hours comes from natural gas, and more than 750,000 gigawatts come from, or 750 gigawatts come hours come from renewables. We wouldn't be there. We wouldn't have almost a third of our state's energy coming from renewables if we, as policy leaders, had not pushed and led on the topic of wind energy. So members, this is the point in time for us to make some big decisions about where we're going in the future. I think that the steps that I proposed in the DE3 are reasonable steps forward. The highlights, the numbers everybody's looking for and asking about, is what is our proposed solar energy standard, and what is our proposed next step in the renewable energy portfolio, which is primarily driven wind development. For a solar standard, what I propose is adopting 0.5% of our energy, just a half a percent of our energy, from solar by 2016, 2% by 2020, and 4% by 2025. I rejected the idea of putting a 10% mandate in law because when you look at what states are doing around the country and what's realistic for us in terms of a pace of adoption and how much of our energy picture solar can meet, I think we have to walk before we run. And we know from other states that 2% by 2020 is practical, pragmatic, and realistic. We also know that our large investor-owned utilities are fully capable of supplying 40% of our energy needs from renewable sources by 2030. So the next question people really focus in on is, how do we pay for it? And what I propose is a 1.33% of our energy dollars that we invest in solar. And we see if this energy source can take off here like it's taken off in Colorado and New Jersey and New Mexico and Arizona. Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey signed a standard into law in July of 2012. And the standard that Chris Christie put forward was 4.1% solar by 2028. Well, I think we can beat New Jersey. So I think we can achieve 4% by 2025. To walk through the bill, members, we'll start at section one. If that's okay, we'll go section by section. The first section of the bill is about allowing third-party leasing in the market. I know we have some work to do on language to address valid concerns that have been raised by the utilities in the state. The idea is that the average person will have more access to participate in our clean energy future if they're allowed to participate through a third-party leasing arrangement. The next sections have to deal with what's considered a just and reasonable rate and allowing solar to be considered as part of a just and reasonable rate. The next section deals with definitions, and then we get to the changes in the proposed net metering limits. I think that there's some work we need to do on this. I asked when Representative Morgan's bill was heard, and we heard a lot of opposition from municipal power agencies and cooperatives, I suggested that they bring forward some language on net metering to help us modernize the statute but account for their very unique needs given their size. And I'm still interested in working with the municipal power agencies and the co-ops on what size of net metering is appropriate for them. There is an off-ramp for distributed generation at Section 9 that allows utilities to say at 5%, that's it. We can't take any more, 5% of our load. That's either too expensive or too unstable for our system, and they can ask for an out from allowing additional distributed generation. Section 10 allows for more uniform contracts. And then at Section 12, we get into the value of solar. The value of solar, I think, was best explained by Carl Ravigo, who came to testify in favor of the governor's energy bill. The beauty of the value of solar is it's about paying to people who have solar what it's worth to the utility. If the utility is completely indifferent to the sources of power that it adds, whether it's more coal or more gas or more renewables, what is the rate that people should be paid for their generation of solar? The language allows for annual review, and the rate could be altered annually. It also allows for specific value of solar rates by utility to acknowledge the different circumstances that different utilities face. Then I think that we're probably going to have more conversation about the renewable energy credits and who owns those and how that fosters a market where we can grow renewable energy in the state. For the time being, I retain the renewable energy credit with the generator of the energy. Section 16, you see the solar standard, and placing it lines 13.30 and 13.31 as a goal that we try to reach for 10%, but not a mandate. The mechanism for how we will get to 2% of our energy from solar power by 2020 is the solar energy production incentive. This is modeled on what we put into place in 1994 as part of the Prairie Island Agreement, when the Renewable Development Fund was used to provide renewable energy production incentives to wind power. At that time, our state's wind industry was in its infancy, and how we got it up and going was we established in statute a per kilowatt hour subsidy for wind generation. We would propose to do the same thing in the area of solar energy, and this portion of statute would be placed right after where we currently have the wind generation renewable energy production incentive, or REPI payments. We provide a bonus for Made in Minnesota, but I did not set forth in the DE3 a particular amount of money that would be allocated to Made in Minnesota. I think that the Department of Commerce needs to have the flexibility to encourage the growth in Made in Minnesota manufacturing, but we need to balance the desire to generate industry in our state with the desire to have cost-effective solar power deployed across the state. So we want to make sure that the incentive is enough to encourage growth in our Minnesota-grown industry, but we want people to shop and get the best deal so that we can expand solar in the state more rapidly. Then we have the provisions of Representative Ray Dean's bill on Property Assessed Clean Energy, or PACE, and that is, I believe, in sections 24 and 25. And then we have a couple of studies. One of the things I'm a little bit disappointed about in the DE3 draft is I would have liked to have done more for solar thermal in this first outing with the D3 amendment. We didn't have very many bills in front of the committee on solar thermal, and so we didn't have good models of how we could incentivize more uptake of solar thermal going forward. So I think that the study about solar thermal It's the last study, and Section 29 is particularly important. And then the other studies will contribute to our future policy making in the area of solar energy. So I'm going to have the pages pass out the rest of my handouts. And I am happy to take questions.
Representative Portman, is that what you prefer right now, is questions from members?
Let's get questions from members, and then I suspect there may be people who wish to testify in favor of or opposed to the...
We'll give them a few minutes to write their speeches. Are there questions from members for Representative Portman? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And either for Representative Portman or for staff, the... I'm trying to find the page. The 1.33%, first of all, here we go. It says, beginning on January 1st, 2014, and each January 1st thereafter, the department shall assess, based on 1.33% of the utility's gross annual retail sales within the state during the preceding calendar year. Am I to understand, then, that this tax or assessment would be, should this legislation become law, is actually, it would be retroactively in effect at the beginning of this year?
Representative Garofalo, I don't understand that to be the case. I understand that the number, the amount to be assessed, will be based on the prior year's revenue.
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Chairman, Representative...
Representative Garofalo.
So the thinking then is that they would start paying it January 1st based off of... They would pay January 1st of 2014 based off of 2013 data?
Representative Portman.
That's my understanding, but I could be wrong. Mr. Eliff can correct me if I am.
Mr. Eliff?
Representative Hortman is correct on that point.
Thank you. Representative Groff.
Hey, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hortman, so would these then be, would they begin paying these assessments, fees, taxes on rates that are collected then, or would there be a lump check that would go out on January 1st to pay for this?
Representative Hortman.
Can you point me to this section, Representative Groff?
Sure. It's page 17, section 22, subdivision 4.
Subdivision
4?
Line 17, page 17, line 19, Representative Portman.
And what is your question, Representative Garofalo?
So Representative Garofalo.
So my question is that since we're basing it off of 2013 data, and it says that beginning on January 1st of 2014, and each January 1st thereafter, the department shall assess under Section 216B, basically the amount 1.33% times the gross annual sales from the previous year. My question for that is that an assessment charge tax that would go on rates going forward from there, or would there be a lump sum check that they would send in on January 1st?
Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, all we provide for in the bill is that the utility pays the 1.33%. How they incorporate that into their rate structure is really up to them and not spelled out in the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hortman, the concern is that for an area that's experiencing volatile or declining customer usage, we base the previous year's assessment on what would actually be assessed on a smaller rate base the following year. So when they're assessing that, the 1.33% would be lower for districts that are, for providers that are growing. It would be higher for ones that are shrinking or having reduced usage. So what you're saying is that in this bill, the utilities are they're a complete discretion of how they would pay that assessment. It could just be a one-time charge, an add-on to the utility bill, a 13th payment from customers. Those are all options they could use.
Representative Portman.
Mr. Eliff is grabbing his microphone. So
Mr. Eliff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, there may be a difference between the assessment and how the assessment is collected by utilities. And I don't think there's anything in the language here that talks about the collection, just the assessment itself. 216B62 does have different procedures by which different assessments can be made, but there's nothing in the bill that speaks exactly to how it will be collected.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, I almost said Representative Eliff. Sorry about that insult. Mr. Eliff, but in that situation where you have areas of declining population or declining usage, from that perspective, the utility is now assessing a 1.33% assessment on what is, to use an analogy, a smaller base. So do we leave that the determination of how much each person needs to pay, do we leave that up to the utilities then, in terms of how it has to be broken down? Because they're going to be making expectations for how much usage is going to occur prospectively, but they're using data for the assessment retroactively.
I'm going to go to Representative Portman on this one, if that's okay, Representative Garofalo. Representative Portman?
I'm happy to defer if Mr. Eliff wanted to add something. But we get to a certain point where we're having a policy discussion and not a technical discussion.
Exactly.
I'm not sure if we've crossed that line yet.
Yeah.
Mr. Eliff, did you have something to add in response to Representative Garofalo's question?
Mr. Eliff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, I guess I don't see in here where there is any assessment based on a prospective customer base.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Graff.
And I'm asking a question here, but I'm happy to have anyone answer it. The thing is that the 1.33% assessment is based off of the, for example, in 2014, we're basing it off of the 2013 usage. We don't know the amount of power that's going to be used in 2014 for each one of these retail providers. So we know what they used in the past. We can have expectations of what would be used in the future. My question is, are we leaving it to the utilities then to determine that?
Representative Horvath.
Representative Garofalo, you are right to the extent that this is retrospective. And so if sales are bigger in 2013 than they're going to be in 2014, that the 1.33% is reflective of 1.33% of 2013 and not of 2014. But I think as a practical matter, it has to be retrospective to come up with the right number.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And regarding the 4% mandate for solar energy, just any different Representative Portman or if staff wants to answer this, what is, just so everyone's using the same numbers, what is 1% of our states using that calculation? What's 1% so everyone has a easy to understand metrics for what these
this
are?
This would be interesting to
Representative
if
Portman?
Mr. Eliff and I have the same number. I know that 2% would be a little over 1,000 megawatt capacity.
Mr. Eliff, Representative Portman seems to be looking to you for support.
Mr. Chair, my recollection is we had testimony to the effect that 1% represented about 500 megawatts.
My recollection as well. Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
My recollection was 520, but I think it's good enough for policy. So, all right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Portman.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. Other questions from members? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman, in this bill, you have energy credits and you have net metering, and you're assigning a higher and elevated rate that the metered customer would get reimbursed for. But then even if the utility is paying this higher rate for that, you know, that power, they aren't getting the credits for what they're buying. Can you explain to me how this is a just and fair, balanced thing that you buy something and don't get the full value? Because part of your calculated value is the intrinsic value of it being renewable.
Representative Portman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, you might remember from Mr. Rabago's testimony that in Austin, that green element was something that they had already had a lot of market experience with for users of the utility opting for the green power purchase, and to that degree was how it was incorporated. There's also environmental considerations that go into the value of solar, so you may be speaking to that.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Portman, it's because of all that's rolled into the elevated premium that the utility is paying for this power that I don't understand why, in addition to that elevated premium with all of these wonderful things rolled in to justify that elevated premium, why you then don't give the renewable energy credit to the people that actually are paying that premium for that, since you're not allowing with this bill the option to not buy that.
It sounds like there are two issues here, the notion of the elevated premium and the notion of the REC ownership. Representative Hortman.
I think we've dispensed with the discussion of the elevated premium, but with regard to the rec ownership, what the bill allows is for the parties to contract about that and negotiate. What the bill allows for that to be something that is bought and sold between the generator and the purchaser. And I brought an expert up to the table to add if he has anything. I'm John Farrell from the Institute on Local Self-Reliance.
Mr. Farrell, would you introduce yourself and state your testimony, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Farrell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Mr. Chair and Representative Plum, with regard to the rec ownership, I am not the expert on rec ownership, but the folks that I work with who do specialize in it have told me that this is mostly about clarifying existing law around rec ownership with regards to existing renewable energy purchases, that the generator does own that rec, and for the purposes of this bill, that clarification is important to establish then how one might have a contractual relationship with the utility about transferring that ownership. So my understanding is it's largely in the realm of a clarification of ownership.
Thank you, Mr. Farrell. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then to that point then, would the chief author be open to having it clarified that this is grandfathered language to protect previous and not forward moving with that restriction of where you have the only and may not, and those are the two words, only and not, on 14, 20, and 21 that gives me some consternation. And I'd feel better if you clarified that, as your expert stated, this is only to maintain consistency with existing contracts, of which I fully understand that we don't want to suborn that unless it's a biomass facility in another bill. But so if you would entertain that, we could maybe work on, you know, comfort language that way and not impose this on the future now that you're doing all these wonderful things.
Representative Horp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Plum, I'm happy to talk to anybody about amendments right up until noon tomorrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one covering this specific issue.
Excellent. Any other questions from members?
I wanted to point members
Representative Horman.
To one of the handouts that I handed out. It's the only one I think that's in color, the map of the United States that shows the renewable portfolio standard policies of other states that also have solar or distributed generation provisions. And when I tried to assess what was the right number for Minnesota, one of the factors that I considered was what the other states were doing. And you can see that Colorado has a 3% distributed generation goal by 2020, which is a full percent higher than what we have here. Colorado got off to a faster start than us. I believe that their policy was put in place in 2008. And they are on track to meet that 3% in distributed generation by 2020. Colorado is also substantially served by Xcel in that market, and they have done a fantastic job of incorporating this standard into the service they provide their customers. You see that in Delaware, it's 3.5% by 2026. Maryland, 2% by 2020, which is exactly the number that I selected for us. New Jersey, as we talked about, Chris Christie brought New Jersey to 4.1% by 2028. The state of Arizona at 4.5% distributed generation by 2025. New Mexico, 4% by 2020, which is twice as much as we will have by 2020. And when you look at the other handouts that I handed out, one of them is about the solar marketplace, and it talks about the number of installations and the cost per installation, and you look at how much total capacity that states have, and you can see that these policies are driving those industries in those states, and they're on track to meet their goals. So I just think when you look at this map and you account for the fact that Minnesota has always been a leader in renewable energy, what's the right place for us on this map? What are the right numbers for us? And looking at the data that of where our energy picture is, the spreadsheet with the coal-fired power plants that are retiring and the size of those coal plants, I think that the numbers that are in the bill are very realistic for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Portman. Other questions from members before we go to testimony from the audience? Well, why don't we do that, Representative Hortman? Why don't we welcome members of the audience down who would like to testify for or against parts or all of the bill?
We're happy to have both proponents and opponents.
Absolutely. We want to hear from everyone.
Agree.
Everyone.
If anybody's had time to digest it by now. I think they all like
could,
it.
We could have the Jeopardy music playing right now, Representative Hornstein.
Controversial.
Representative Hornstein.
Well,
Representative Hortman.
If we have exhausted questions from members and feedback from the public, we can always adjourn the committee early today and give people more time to work on their amendments.
Work on their amendments.
I'm happy to discuss the D3 in greater depth.
Representative Garofalo, would that be a good idea for you?
I'm done. I would, if we have the data available, if we could have it before tomorrow, it would just be good to know what this costs.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo. I think I have a spreadsheet on that.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, without further interest, I'm sorry. Oh, we need a motion to approve the minutes from yesterday. Representative Falk, have you had a chance to look at the minutes? Representative Falk moves the minutes from March 11. Thank you. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The minutes from March 11 are approved. Yes, Representative Garofalo.
Just very briefly, Republican members will be meeting in Representative Beard's office very quickly.
All right. Thank you very much. Any other questions or comments? Then the meeting is adjourned.